Hey, before we get to the show, I wanted to remind you to check out our Patreon at patreon.com/curbsiders. If you haven't signed up yet, sign up now to get ad-free episodes, twice monthly bonus episodes, and a whole bunch of other cool stuff at patreon.com/curbsiders. Paul, it's the middle of summer, but if you ever get cold, just stand in a corner of a room for a while.
I have a feeling I'm not going to get this one because it's going to be so awful. So go
yes,
ahead and do
I
what you
have
must.
Great shame. Paul, you got to stand in the corner because they're always 90 degrees.
Yeah, no, I would not have gotten there because that's very bad.
Thank you, Paul. And I'm sorry to the audience. I'll do better next time.
The Curbsiders podcast is for entertainment, education, and information purposes only, and the topics discussed should not be used solely to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any diseases or conditions. Furthermore, the views and statements expressed on this podcast are solely those of the host and should not be interpreted to reflect official policy or position of any entity, aside from possibly Cash Like More Hospital and affiliate outreach programs, if indeed there are any. In fact, there are none. Pretty much, we aren't responsible if you screw up. You should always do your own homework and let us know when we're wrong.
Welcome back to the Curbsiders. I'm Dr. Matthew Frankwato, here with my great friend and America's primary care physician, Dr. Paul Nelson Williams. Paul, how you doing?
I'm doing great, Matt. Thanks for asking. How are you?
I'm doing well. We had a fantastic returning guest, Dr. Joel Tuff, talking about hypo and hyperkalemia. And, you know, hearing him talk about electrolytes, Paul, it's always been a favorite of mine and of our audience because they can't get enough Joel Tuff, neither can we.
Yeah, and this I can never get enough of the fundamentals too, which we cover in great detail in this episode. Joel's the best. He makes everything just so concrete.
So, Paul, why don't you tell everyone what did we do in general on Curbsiders, and then you can introduce our wonderful co-host.
Sure. Happy to, Matt. As a reminder, we are the internal medicine podcast. We use expert interviews to bring you clinical pearls and practice-changing knowledge. Matt, as you mentioned, we are joined by Dr. Sai Achi, who is a frequent co-host, super producer extraordinaire, including of this episode. Sai, how are you?
I'm good. How are you?
I'm well. Thank you for asking. Why don't I let you tell us about who we talked to? Not that he needs much of an introduction to our audience, and then maybe even just a little bit about what we talked about.
Sure. So we had a fantastic conversation with our guest, Dr. Joel Tuff. Joel went to med school in Wayne State University School of Medicine and did a med-peds residency at Indiana University, after which he did an adult fellowship in nephrology at the University of Chicago. He is currently an associate clinical professor of medicine at Oakland University William Beaumont School of Medicine. Joel's passions include using social media and new media to teach nephrology. He is the co-creator of Neph Madness and NephJC. In addition to being a regular guest on the Curbsiders, he's also created and hosted two nephrology podcasts, Freely Filtered and the award-winning Channel Your Enthusiasm. In 2017, the American Society of Nephrology awarded him the Robert G. Nairns Award for Innovation in Teaching. So today he taught us how to formulate a framework for potassium disorders and the importance of being as concerned about hypokalemia as we are about hyperkalemia, and the various treatment options we have for potassium disorders in patients with varying kidney functions. So without further ado, let's get to it.
A reminder that this and most episodes will be available for CME credit for all health professionals through VCU Health at curbsiders.vcuhealth.org. Joel, you've been on the show dozens of times, and we're always excited to have you back. What's your latest hobby? You always have something interesting going on.
So my family and I, we just went on a canoe trip in the Boundary Waters Canoe Area, which is a wilderness area in northern Minnesota. Like, go to Duluth, and believe it or not, you can drive 2 hours north from Duluth, and there's this absolutely epic canoe area. It's a chain of lakes, and you paddle on a lake for an hour or so, then you take your canoe out of the lake, put it on your back, cross over to the next lake, put the canoe back in and canoe there. It's phenomenal. We were seeing loons and ducks and turtles, and we were worried about seeing bears. We never saw a bear. We were worried about seeing moose. We never saw any moose, but it was amazing. It was incredible. And my kids are 23, and an opportunity to go on a family vacation with the kids and my wife, no significant others, nobody else. It was really special. It was awesome.
Oh, I'm always anxious to unlock a new anxiety. Why should I be scared about moose?
It's not the moose. What you should be scared of is the Lyme disease up there. So we got, there were ticks everywhere, lots of bugs. It was, there was a lot of creepy crawlies. There is a real downside to the Boundary Waters. Maybe December would be a better time.
If you call me next time, I'll give you some doxycycline and, you know, you can bring it with you. And
I'm looking for the target lesions right now.
Soak your clothes in permethrin and it's good for 5 or 6 washes. Yeah. Paul and I learned about this recently. Yeah,
great episode coming out, or has come out.
Has come out, yeah. Okay, well, Cy, we have a lot to cover, and we wanna just soak in all the knowledge we can from Kidney Boy. So, Cy, can you read our first case?
Yep, let's do it. So we have Cal Lima, is a 40-year-old man with a history of diet-controlled diabetes mellitus who comes to your clinic to follow up on labs. He says he's been doing well and has been spending some time trying to perfect his banana bread recipe. So initial vitals were stable for him. He had a visit about a week ago, and you did some labs at that time. He had a potassium of 5.4 and a BUN of 48 with a creatinine of 1.42 and an EGFR of 47. And that sample at that time was non-hemolyzed. So he's coming back and had some repeat blood work done at this visit. So his sodium now is 138, potassium of 5.9, chloride of 108, bicarb of 19 with a glucose of 218 and a BUN of 48. His creatinine now is 1.45 with an EGFR of 45. He recently started taking a new medication for adult onset acne. So just wanted to kind of dive into this case and see, is there a framework on how you'd approach a patient with hyperkalemia? Are there any other lab values that we need to be paying attention to aside from the potassium?
Yeah, awesome. So what we've got is we've got a patient with modest and stable CKD with modest hyperkalemia, right? Potassium was 5.4 in the initial lab and came back at 5.7. So I've worked in a ton of different hospitals, and a potassium of 5.4 on some has been the upper limit of normal and others has been flagged as high. So that's kind of borderline. I've never seen 5.7 be anything but an elevated potassium. So this guy definitely has hyperkalemia. And the question is it real or not? Right. And so, you know, you mentioned that first draw was not hemolyzed. And this is an automatic, this is, you know, a constant concern of the pathologist. They're developing methodologies looking for hemolysis and they automatically check it. So this is they know this is a problem. They're always looking for it and they will flag it if it's got hemolysis. You just need to take the moment to open that comment section when you get the labs. You also need to look for, you know, that hemolysis might not just be from a disrupted hemolysis after the draw, but even before the draw. So if there's a tight tourniquet or the tourniquet's been on there for a long time or there's excessive fist pumping, all of these can cause a pseudo hyperkalemia. This guy does have some reasons where he may have hyperkalemia, that, you know, he does have CKD, which puts him at higher risk for that. He does have diabetes, though it is diet controlled, which also puts him at higher risk for that. We worry about hyperglycemia, and I don't think we have a glucose shown here. And we also have what looks like metabolic acidosis. So there's a number of things that make me think that this could be real, but it's got to be the most important kind of checklist when you first see these patients, like, is this real or is this an artifact? And we don't have the time of day, but there's actually some pretty interesting data, especially for outpatient labs. If it's the winter and it's cold out, that will cause more pseudohyperkalemia. That just the transporting the blood in cold weather results in more hemolysis. So great data coming out of studies done in South Africa and Australia and in England, where they've shown that kind of consistently.
That's fascinating. And by the way, this guy, we are giving him a glucose of 218.
218, right? So some modest hyperglycemia, but not enough for me to really worry about that being driving the hyperglycemia. And again, the hyperkalemia. And again, what you get with severe hyperglycemia is you get what's called solute drag. Is as that glucose rises in the extracellular compartment, it pulls water from the intracellular compartment, and that water just drags potassium out, and it'll cause hyperkalemia. And that can be pretty dramatic, and so something that you want to consider, and an easy thing to fix also. Like before you start going to any kind of exotic cocktails, if you just get that glucose under control, you know, they come in with that glucose of 400 or 450, getting that glucose under control will usually take care of your potassium pretty quickly.
So we had step one, is it real or not? And you gave us some reasons there. Make sure it's not too cold outside. You talked about intake a little bit. Where do you go to after that? Yeah. Is it real
so,
thing?
And anytime I deal with potassium, I kind of have the three basic processes that the body uses. It looks at a potassium intake, then cellular distribution, and then finally excretion. And I use that same schema to think about the differential, to think about the treatment, and to think about what could be happening here. And so, you know, the first one is intake. So could you have increased potassium intake? And the important thing is that dietary intake alone is rarely the cause of hyperkalemia. It can be on unusual circumstances, but usually it's just a contributor. And so you don't want to just say, hey, it's, you know, the first thing you want to say, you know, in the stem, it says he's working on banana bread. He's eating a lot of banana bread. It's just a setup. You just love that. You're like, oh, that must be what the story is. And you'll come across patients where, you know, it's tomato season. They bought a bunch of fresh tomatoes and they eat a bunch of tomatoes, or they're now on a smoothie kick and they're having a strawberry banana smoothies every morning. Like, there are exceptions, but generally the body is really good at adjusting potassium intake. And there's actually been some nice studies that have looked at potassium intake and its relationship to serum potassium, and it's a scatter plot. There's almost no relationship. The R squared value is like 0.1, saying that about 10% of the variability in potassium can be explained by the potassium intake, which seems crazy, right? You'd think it would be one of the most important things, and especially by how often we talk about, hey, let's do a dietary recall. Let's talk about what you're eating. And as soon as they know that they're potassium, the patients are like, oh, I've been eating a lot of bananas, or I've been eating, you know, fresh fruit. Like, they'll help you out. They want to get to the answer also. And they, you know, and it's the easy thing, but it rarely is the actual thing.
I will say that for this patient with quote-unquote diet-controlled diabetes, if we're going to be horking down banana bread all day long, I'm more concerned about that than I'm about the hyperkalemia.
Yeah, that's right. And then the other thing to think about with not all foods yield the same potassium effect, that we're really beginning to understand the bioavailability of potassium in the foods. And some potassium is highly bioavailable, and that's going to be the mineral potassium. So if patients are eating potassium chloride, and where they get that is in a salt substitute, right? So you told them, hey, why don't you go on a low sodium diet? And they go to the store and there's Morton's low salt. I know we're not supposed to use brand names, but I get a lot of money from Big Salt. And
I think we're okay with salt brand names, but not salt brand name, right? Just okay. Not pharmaceuticals.
Okay, great. So Morton's no salt or Morton's low salt is a mixture of sodium chloride and potassium chloride. And that's the way it lowers the sodium load. And that potassium chloride is highly bioavailable, essentially 100% bioavailable. And then the other half of that is going to be mainly fruits, which is potassium citrate, not potassium chloride. And that's about 50% bioavailable. And so there's that potassium is just, most of it's not there. Plus there's a lot of fiber in that fruit. And vegetables also, and that fiber helps colonic excretion of potassium. And especially as we get to deeper and deeper levels of CKD, that colonic excretion of potassium actually becomes pretty significant, accounting for about 30 to 50% of potassium excretion, depending on the individual.
Yeah. I think a lot of people, just their mind immediately goes to, oh, my potassium's high. It's something I'm doing. It's my food. But you're saying it's often not that unless there's some specific situations, like they're really going overboard with something. And you mentioned this salt substitutes. That's one of the hidden spots where people are getting potassium chloride and they might not realize it. And that can really add up.
Absolutely. Nailed it. Yeah. Patients want to reach for that. Doctors want to give them dietary advice. People like to use diet to help their health. The reality is that GFR is a much tighter relationship to serum potassium than total potassium intake in the day.
Yeah. Okay. So that's the intake piece. How about the distribution, the excretion? How does that account? How do you account for that?
Right. So, you know, the thing to remember is that 98 to 99% of all body potassium is inside the cells, right? And so anything that causes inside of cells to become outside of cells. So rhabdo, tumor lysis syndrome, periodic paralysis, hemolysis, all of those can cause hyperkalemia. Again, those all are pretty acute events. Patients usually are pretty sick when they have those. Those are going to be pretty profound or obvious presentations. I don't think that applies to this patient, but it's part of the schema to think about. Like, could this be intracellular potassium that's going out? Two other things are DIGE toxicity, because DIGE toxicity poisons the sodium potassium transporter, and so they will get hyperkalemia. And then insulin deficiency, mostly.
Like type 1?
Type 1 diabetes? DKA type picture, they'll get the hyperkalemia there. And we talked a little bit about the hyperosmolality with the elevated glucose, and that would also fit under here. And then the last one, he also has, we talked about the metabolic acidosis, and the metabolic acidosis will also cause that shift, and that potassium will be going out of the cells as hydrogen goes into the cells. So you get that exchange. That's kind of what we think about with cellular distribution. Okay, and then the big dog here is going to be excretion. And kind of the way I always teach my fellows is that if they have chronic hyperkalemia, if it's not just a transient issue, they will have an inability to excrete potassium. That's where the rubber meets the road. There always will be that. There may be other factors that are contributing, but for it to be chronic, persistent hyperkalemia, you need to have failures of excretion. And the number one here is going to be chronic kidney disease. As that GFR falls, the risk of hyperkalemia goes up higher and higher. And it's pretty remarkable how little it's associated, right? Like, you can go from a GFR of 100 down to 20 and not see much hyperkalemia. If you lost 80% of your GFR, and your potassium may go up a bit. It's pretty remarkable how little it's associated, right? How well the body is able to tolerate that and adjust that. But it's still a huge risk factor and probably the dominant risk factor for hyperkalemia. And then in addition, so that's just GFR. Then the other one are all the ways that we suppress the renin-angiotensin-aldosterone system. And so we have all kinds of drugs that we do that. We have the ACE inhibitors, we have the angiotensin receptor blockers, we have direct renin inhibitors, and now we have a mineralocorticoid receptor antagonists, and now we have a brand new aldosterone synthase inhibitors. All of these will lead to hyperkalemia reliably. And this patient was started on a new acne drug. And we didn't ask, we don't know the identity of that drug, but the thing that you want to ask about is, are you on spironolactone? Which is used at high doses, like kind of shockingly high doses. Like the first time I saw the patient come in on 100 milligrams of Aldo or Spiro from their dermatologist, my head exploded, right? And the most amazing thing is how well they tolerate it. Right, like I'm the ninny here, you know, getting nervous about ordering 25 milligrams, and the dermatologist is flinging around 100 milligrams without even thinking about it. Right, it's just like, wow.
That makes me feel so much better, because I've seen that a bunch of times where I'm like, all right, we'll cautiously start 25. We're gonna check your K in like 3 days, then again in 2 weeks. Meanwhile, it's like, oh, acne, here you go. You just take all the spironolactone, no problem. And you're right, and the patients by and large do incredibly well.
They do fine. Yeah,
I think they're mostly treating like young, healthy women with that, with 100 of spironolactone. Because if it's a man, like I hope they're not throwing 100 of spironolactone at men. You're gonna develop breasts, or at least breast tenderness, and all sorts of other sexual health problems.
100%. In fact, you guys did a primary hyperaldo episode at the beginning of the year that was phenomenal. And talk about practice changing. Like, one of the things that the guest said, he's like, I just don't even use Spiro for men now. I just go right to eplerenone. Yeah. And I had not done that. I had always done that as a second stage. Let's let them be intolerant to Spiro. And I was like, as soon as he said that, I was like, yeah, what am I doing? Of course I'm going to do that. And it was like a switch, and I absolutely changed my practice.
Yeah. And now there's some of those pharmacies, like there's wholesale pharmacies where you can get a better price on that drug compared to going through
insurance. You can say eplerenone.
Yeah. No, I mean, but I was trying not to say the name of the pharmacy, but yeah, eplerenone, yeah. You can get, yeah.
Yeah, it's not, yeah, that's right. It's not like, right. We're old enough that we remember when it was on patent, or at least I'm old enough to remember when it was on patent, and it's been a while.
Right.
It's off patent. It's not that expensive now.
Yeah.
That's right.
This episode is brought to you by Doc Update. Founded by a dermatologist, Doc Update is a free app with HIPAA-compliant tools built for healthcare providers. Away from your EHR and need to send a prescription, e-prescribe right from your phone. Interpreter unavailable? Use Doc Update's AI medical translator with more than 20 languages for patient conversations. Need medication samples, copay cards, or patient support? Request them through Doc Update's concierge instead of searching across multiple websites. It's free, mobile, and built around the realities of patient care. Download Doc Update today, free on the Apple App Store and Google Play Store. This episode is brought to you by Delete Me. Every so often, I'll unleash maybe too spicy a take on social media, or I'll do a bit of an overshare on the podcast, and I think to myself, ugh, I really should be doing something to protect myself from stalkers or scammers or hackers, but I'm not quite sure what. And here's what I should do. I should go to www.joindeleteme.com/curb and enter code CURB. You get 20% off Delete Me. In this age of AI, we are all especially vulnerable to scammers using your personal data that's just floating around on the internet. Have you ever Googled yourself and found your home address, phone number, or the name of a family member? It is unsettling, but the good news is Delete Me can help. Delete Me was named the top pick for data removal services by Wirecutter. Get an individual plan for a little over $8 per month. As I mentioned, I am someone who is almost entirely too online. I probably overshare. I think there's a lot of details about my life that I maybe should second guess thinking about putting that back out there. And yet, conversely, privacy is really important to me. And that's why a product like Delete Me can be so very useful. So take control of your data and keep your private life private by signing up for Delete Me. Now at a special discount for our listeners. Get 20% off your Delete Me plan when you go to joindeleteme.com/curb and use promo code CURB at checkout. The only way to get 20% off is to go to www.joindeleteme.com/curb and enter code CURB at checkout. That's www.joindeleteme.com/curb, code CURB.
Okay. We talked about the kind of first, is it real? Then the big three things. Excretion is the big dog, you said, especially for chronic hyperkalemia.
Yeah.
And then distribution and intake are the other two.
But I want to go back to drugs. So we hit the ones that everybody thinks about are going to be the RASI, the renin angiotensin aldosterone system inhibitors. But I want to, there's a couple of others that you should be aware of. So one is NSAIDs, and that's like, it's, they're all over the place, and we always are focused on how they affect the GFR, but they also just suppress aldosterone release. And so it's just an important thing to keep an eye on. NSAIDs, you know, people can take them, they're off, they're over the counter. Be aware of that. And that can be somebody who's stable for a long time, and all of a sudden they get, you know, a weekend injury, and they start taking ibuprofen or what have you, and their potassium can spike up. So that's one to keep in mind. Trimsulfa, the antibiotic, has an amiloride-like effect, a potassium-sparing diuretic effect. And so that's another one that they can be doing just fine, cruising right along, and then they get, you know, a URI or what have you, and they get put on Trimsulfa, and they can get hyperkalemia there. And then more relevant for transplant, but of course, tacrolimus or the calcineurin inhibitors also can cause hyperkalemia. And then this guy's not, he's only 40 years old, but as men age, you always need to worry about urinary obstruction. Of course, women also, but urinary obstruction is causes a specific potassium secretion deficit. So in addition to having some AKI, they'll have hyperkalemia out of proportion to their degree of AKI. And so that's always something you want to be looking for.
Paul, where do you want to go with this next?
I guess, I'd like to ask, Joel, how would your framework change in a patient without underlying CKD? And I don't want to jump ahead here. Maybe there's another time to talk about this, but I do feel like there is a certain subset of patients where they actually have an intact eGFR. We don't have chronic kidney disease. We don't have suspicion, but their K is still kind of lightly elevated and not so much that it's panicking, but also just persistent. So how do you think about that or sort of start to evaluate that? Because that's something I feel like I struggle with a fair amount.
Yeah. So first of all, you know, it's kind of a change in your Bayesian probability, like the likelihood that this is true hyperkalemia in patients with intact kidney function just really goes down. Like even if they're on RAS inhibition, if they have intact kidneys, they usually don't get hyperkalemia. And so I just would be much more careful to think about, are we looking at a bad blood draw? And I would really focus on repeating it, making sure what we have is correct. And then, you know, the other thing is I would also look for obstruction would be another thing that could show up where they could just, the only symptom they could have would be some hyperkalemia there, maybe not even any AKI. And then kind of the medications that we talked about would be the other issues. Probably that's the extent of it.
Okay, great.
Yeah. You do, every once in a while, we do come across those cases where we can't figure out what caused it, but usually it's the blood draw, in my experience. Like, usually, once in a while, they'll be like, oh yeah, I was taking a potassium supplement or something silly like that. And you're just like, okay, don't do that. But usually you usually can figure something out.
Right. And remember, I mean, there's just revision to the mean. Like, when you get an abnormally high one, you repeat it, and it's more likely to not go back to normal.
Yeah, these mild cases in particular, in either direction, are really amenable to the Williams technique of just checking the lab until you get a number you like, I have found.
Sai, you want to read the next part of the case?
Sure. So after all this discussion, Cal's becoming pretty fascinated about learning more about potassium levels and wants to just get more information about what are some of the predilections and causes for his hyperkalemia or in hyperkalemia in general. And he wants to see, are there any changes that he can start making now so that he can see some improvements in his potassium?
Right. So, I mean, you know, for patients that get interested in these types of things, you know, the repeat labs are great for that, and people love to kind of see serial potassiums. I don't think we have continuous potassium monitoring yet, but you just wait. That's probably coming down the pipe, And for this guy, I would want to focus on his diabetes management. This is a guy that was eating a lot of banana bread. I would want to talk to him about, you know, how is his glucose being controlled? I know it was pretty good when we checked it then, but is it always so good? And then I would talk about diet. I would look and say, are we having constipation? So constipation can be something that will contribute to some hyperkalemia, can cause some obstruction. You can lose some of that colonic excretion of potassium. And so, and this is an important one because patients will look up on, go to the internet, find out which has high potassiums, and they'll start stopping a lot of these foods that are high in fiber, right? And you just, you got to say, hey, there's good potassium. Whole foods are really good, high fiber, low bioavailability of the potassium. You want to make sure that they stay on those. Because if you start looking at foods that are low in potassium, you start getting a pretty crappy diet. You start avoiding a lot of things that are good for you. And I think in the end, you're not benefiting the patient there. And so you kind of want to say, hey, yeah, the dietary potassium is not a good relationship to the serum potassium. These foods are really important for your general health. We want you to continue to eat fresh whole foods, especially fruits and vegetables. And we want you to lean towards these high alkali foods like the foods with potassium citrate in the fruits and vegetables. Those are gonna be beneficial. They're gonna help your pH status. They're gonna continue to provide a high fiber diet, and they have that low potassium bioavailability. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, the other thing to think about we hadn't talked about yet is, could this patient have adrenal insufficiency? Like, is it worthwhile taking a look at a cortisol? Probably, you know, that random cortisol not so helpful in patients that are not stressed, and you might need to do a cosentropin stim test to actually test for that. But if they have hyperkalemia, you have no other explanation, probably not a bad thing to consider and evaluate, especially if the patient is interested and motivated and says, yeah, I really want to know why this is happening, and you're getting this persistent finding over time. You know, their blood pressure running a little bit low. I don't know, maybe. Maybe that's why they're diet controlled. They have no cortisol.
Interesting. I don't think I've ever done, I can say I definitely have never done a cortisol stim test on somebody that had hyperkalemia. That's not
well. In addition to looking for cortisol, just taking a look at for aldosterone, make sure they're not hypoaldo, which pretty unusual, but again, something that you can test for.
Okay. So the other thing, and Joel, I asked you about this like pretty close to what we started. So I know you haven't done a deep dive on the electrolyte stuff, but I know that that's something that people are taking a lot of now. It didn't look like those have tons of like potassium in them. So that's not a current, I'm not telling any of my patients to take those electrolyte things unless they're like, you know, triathletes or something like that. And they're in a long, like some long event. But do you have any issues with the electrolyte craze that's going on right now?
It doesn't look like the potassium. It's not that high. We were just doing a quick check. So LMNT, which is actually a great name, by the way, LMNT. only has 200 milligrams of potassium. So that's about 5 milliequivalents of potassium. recommended daily allowance is 80 milliequivalents of potassium, so it's just not that much. And then liquid IV has closer to 10, a little less than 10, 9 milliequivalents of potassium in it, so a little bit more, but still not that much compared to your recommended daily allowance of 80. And unfortunately, American diets are pretty low in potassium, so we're only seeing about 40, especially in patients that live in food deserts. In the end, hypokalemia is a much more common problem than hyperkalemia. We're seeing more and more of that. I think we have a case later that we'll talk.
Yeah.
We'll get an opportunity to talk about hypokalemia.
And we had, and those with those electrolyte things, for a lot of our internal medicine patients, those have like a pretty big sodium load, many of them, like 1,000 milligrams in a packet. And for a person who's like exercising for like 20 minutes on a treadmill, they don't need to like rehydrate with that, you know, because they're probably already getting too much sodium in their diet. So I do worry about that part of things. And I just love the like food first approach in general to things, because you're getting the fiber with it, you're getting the water, things are just in their natural ratios. So I like that. And I was listening back because we did a Neph Madness episode a couple years ago. We had a dietitian on with us. I don't know if you remember. And Joel, we were talking about at that time just starting to challenge this idea that like you don't have to cut out like all the fruits and vegetables, and actually you can still exercise, because even if your potassium goes up slightly during exercise, it comes down afterwards for several hours. And we talked about the constipation, you know, avoiding constipation, and these are much more natural ways, and you can still live a more reasonable life. Because I saw a patient a couple of weeks ago who he had a potassium of 5.7, and he just stopped eating like all fruits and vegetables. No one mentioned to him that like processed meats have potentially a lot more potassium in them too. And so we really had to do a lot of that education around it.
So Joel, this is an internal medicine podcast. We have a nephrologist on. If we don't talk about sodium, we probably will lose our podcasting license. So could you sort of talk us through the relationship between sodium and potassium? How do you relate those two things in terms of their interactions, and sort of how to think about one in regard to the other?
It's gotten incredibly fascinating. So one of the newer pieces of physiology that's been elucidated in the last 10 or 20 years. So well after I finished medical school, something called the potassium switch. And did you guys learn about the potassium switch when you were in medical school?
No.
Yeah, I didn't think so. I think it's new enough that it's not in the textbooks, but it's actually pretty profound. And this, you know, when you think about how much we worry about potassium, you're like, boy, the kidney must really be good at protecting us from hyperkalemia. And this is one of the examples of that, is that kind of in anticipation, once you eat the potassium, before the serum potassium has even gone up in the blood, the kidney detects that, and there's a shift in the distal convoluted tubule. So again, I just want to, let's orient ourselves. We have the glomerulus, then you go to the proximal tubule, then you have the long loop of Henle, and then you have what's called the distal nephron. It begins with the distal convoluted tubule, and the important part of the distal convoluted tubule is the thiazide-sensitive sodium chloride reabsorption, okay? And with the potassium switch, when you have this anticipation of a potassium load, it shuts down, it has a thiazide-like effect in the distal convoluted tubule. And so you don't reabsorb much sodium, more of that sodium gets delivered distally to the cortical and medullary collecting duct, and that's the business part of the kidney when it comes to potassium excretion. So that increased sodium delivery results in more sodium excretion, it's a thiazide-like effect, and more potassium excretion, just like you would get with a thiazide. And so the increased potassium intake, essentially just think of it as an endogenous thiazide-type effect. It shuts down the exact same transporter in the distal convoluted tubule and has the same effect, increased sodium excretion and increased potassium excretion. So one, it's great. This is a mechanism to protect you from hyperkalemia, increased potassium excretion, increased potassium intake resulting in increased potassium excretion. But the fact that it also increases sodium excretion, well, that would be useful for hypertension. And we've seen, I remember looking at data long ago that said, hey, look at increased potassium intake. Looks like it lowers the blood pressure pretty effectively. Mm-hmm. And there was this wonderful trial that was done a couple of years ago called the SAS trial. And this was done in rural China. And it's like, it's, I think it's one of these super ambitious trials. I think they, it's a huge trial. They enrolled, the unit of randomization was rural villages in China. Yes. And so, a rural village would get randomized to a one of these salt substitutes where it was 25% potassium chloride and 75% sodium chloride, and another village would get randomized to just sodium chloride. And then they, though the village was randomized, so everybody in the village that was part of the trial would be in the same arm, but not everybody in the village was enrolled. Like they look for patients that were at high risk for stroke is what they were looking for. And that's, and that was the outcome of the trial, was looking for stroke and cardiovascular disease. And the patients that were enrolled with the high potassium, low sodium, and it was a very modest amount of, when you actually looked at the 24-hour urines and what the delta was, it was very modest, but they found a meaningful 12-15% reduction in stroke, total mortality, and a modest decrease in blood pressure just with this potassium supplementation. And it's just, it's this potassium switch in action. It's like, hey, what if we give people additional potassium in the most bioavailable form? Boy, we see a drop in stroke, we see a drop in total mortality, and a drop in blood pressure.
Yeah, fascinating stuff.
Yeah, and they made a lot of crow in the article about it. And we saw almost no hyperkalemia. And then you read the methods, and they're like, we didn't even look for hyperkalemia. I was like, well, I'm not sure you should make a big deal about that, right? Sure.
Can't find a fever if you don't look for it, Joel. It's one of the rules of the house of God.
100%.
Okay. Sai, what else do we want to, are we still in diet intake world? What else, any other things you want to ask about?
Just one part was, wanting to hash out, with heart failure and these goal-directed medical therapies that we hear about, is there any caution or is there a workaround because of the potassium, issue that we encounter?
I think this is the thing that we're always constantly juggling. We have all these therapies that are great for heart failure, and they all tend to raise the potassium, right? We've got ACE and ARBs, we got mineralocorticoid receptor antagonists, and they both drive that potassium up, and we want to put patients on both of these, and especially patients that have diabetes that are already prone to hyperkalemia, patients with CKD that are already prone to hyperkalemia. And the thing to remember is that these drugs are proven to reduce the, not only heart failure mortality, but also CKD. They slow the progression of CKD. So there's all the reasons that you want to keep people on these drugs. And at the same time, you're like, well, I'm running into hyperkalemia. Maybe I should stop them. And I think you want to just first orient yourself and say, hey, the important thing is total mortality. Like, these drugs were kept on, you want to try to maintain them as much as possible, and you don't want to run away at the first sign of hyperkalemia. You want to try to manage it and stop the drugs only when you can't continue them. And there was a couple of randomized controlled trials in patients with chronic kidney disease that said, hey, these patients have a falling creatinine, maybe we should stop the ACE inhibitor, maybe we should stop the angiotensin receptor blocker, recover some of that GFR, and that would keep the patients off of dialysis. It did not work. Right. What happened is they stopped the ACE inhibitor and they died of cardiovascular disease. And you're like, well, I guess they didn't go on dialysis, but, you know, not for the reason you didn't want. So, you know, the first rule is we first want to maintain them. And then the second thing to remember is that SGLT2 inhibitors decrease the risk of hyperkalemia from ACE inhibitors. It didn't work so well for mineralocorticoid receptor antagonists, but, you know, the first line is going to be that ACE inhibitor. So getting them on the SGLT2 inhibitor can help. And I try to get them on that SGLT2 inhibitor as early as possible, usually before I maximize the ACE inhibitor. Because my thought there is that I might be able to get a higher dose of the ACE inhibitor once they're on the SGLT2 inhibitor. And so that's helpful. Then you want to try to maintain their, make sure they're not hyperglycemic. You want to make sure they're not, don't have metabolic acidosis. You can correct that with sodium bicarbonate, and that can help keep the potassium controlled. And then use your loop and thiazide type diuretics. That's going to help you maintain the potassium. Remember that old chestnut about not using thiazides once their GFR falls below 30 is not true. That was a lie you were told in medical school. You can use thiazide, specifically chlorthalidone, was used to deep into GFRs of in the teens, and it was effective. And they did have hypokalemia, so it seems like it would be a good drug to prevent hyperkalemia. And so lean on your diuretics to help maintain that. And that we now have tolerable, though expensive, potassium binders. And these have been shown, proven in multiple trials, to allow patients to maintain their GDMT. Now, the data we'd really like to see that has not been done yet is, does using these drugs to maintain these to maintain use of GDMT, does that result in better heart failure outcomes? And that data has not been collected. There was a couple of attempts to get that, but they ran into COVID and they weren't able to complete the studies. But my sense is, until we see data that it doesn't work, we should consider that it works. I think the burden of proof is showing that it doesn't work, just because we have good data that these drugs, even in patients with advanced CKD, do prevent cardiovascular disease and slow the progression of kidney disease. And so I'm just careful in selecting patients that understand why they're taking this powdered drink once, twice, three, four times a week to allow them to stay on their GDMT. And some patients are sophisticated and some people are less sophisticated. Some people you think are going to be able to continue to take that medication. Other patients are a little bit more tenuous, and you just need to individualize on that. And then the other thing I focus on, make sure they're moving their bowels regularly. Keep a high fiber diet. Don't let them get constipated. And I use frequent blood monitoring. You know, make sure we're checking that, make sure that potassium's controlled, especially if you're making any changes to any medications.
Joel, so it sounds like with the potassium binders, even though we don't have data that keep using those to keep people on these medications improves mortality or cardiovascular outcomes, they seem to be safe and they seem to slow progression of kidney disease. So that's kind of making the trade-off?
What I would say is that they are safe and they allow people to stay on their GDMT.
Yeah, okay.
And we assume if they stay on their GDMT, they're going to get the better outcomes that the GDMT promise.
Okay.
But that study didn't get run to completion, and so we don't know.
And what about the cost? Like, so patiramer and sodium zirconium, is it silicate?
Cyclosilicate.
So
you got to have a good name. I call it the Zerk. So you know, when their potassium is high, you got to Zerk it off.
Okay. So if I'm prescribing some Zerk for somebody, what's that going to run them on the street these days?
I think it's about $600 a month for 10 grams a day. I believe that's
and,
what the
and
cost
a lot
is.
Of your patients are getting by with just a couple doses a week, it sounds like.
And I have patients that get by with a few doses a week, and you kind of individualize it. Absolutely.
Okay. Yeah, so it's still is insurance. If in your hands, like if you're sending the order, is it getting covered for people, or are you getting a lot of this? Like, you know, because there's too many meds on the list right now where I'm fighting for prior auths and things like that.
Yeah, that's the situation. I always feel uncomfortable prescribing the $600 med to keep the 25-cent lisinopril running. Right? It just feels it feels strange. And I've had cases like patients says they're in the hospital with hyperkalemia, and I say what happened? He's like, I was having trouble getting my medications, but don't worry, Dr. Duff, I did not stop my losartan, because they know that I really want them to be on the losartan. Or like, you know, I'm like, they couldn't get the zirconium, but they got the losartan and they kept going with that, and they ended up with hyperkalemia. And so it's tough. It's hard. Patients are confused. And it's not that patients are confused. It's that these are complex and they're unfamiliar to patients, and they expect us to be able to help them out with this.
This episode is brought to you by Figs. I remember when I was in medical school a million years ago, my scrubs were lovingly collected from various ORs. They were mismatched. They did not fit well. They maybe had the hospital's name printed across the backside. And as I was reminiscing about my experience with medical school, I'm reminded that back to school season is here. And while that means lectures, labs, and late nights for healthcare workers in training, it's also a reminder that in medicine, education never really ends. Figs, the premium apparel brand for healthcare professionals, just dropped fresh colors and exclusive back to school styles. From scrubs to outerwear to footwear and beyond, Figs keeps awesome humans looking sharp, performing their best, and ready to take on anything, from marathon lab sessions to 12-hour shifts. So if you're in healthcare or know someone who is, get 15% off your first order at wearfigs.com with code FIGSRX. That's wearfigs.com, code FIGSRX. This episode is brought to you by Continuing Education Company. Hey, Curbsiders listeners, have you ever chosen a CME conference because of the destination, only to be disappointed by the education once you got there? That's where Continuing Education Company really stands out. They host conferences in places clinicians want to visit, like Maui, the Big Island of Hawaii, several locations in Florida, including the Florida Keys, Nashville, and Austin, Texas, but they pair those destinations with education that actually delivers. This fall, CEC is offering a hospitalist conference in Nashville and an urgent care and emergency medicine conference in Austin. The Austin conference focuses on practical acute care topics that clinicians encounter every day, whether they practice in primary care, urgent care, hospital medicine, or the emergency department. Their meetings are structured as half-day morning sessions so you get focused, practical learning without feeling overwhelmed. And because your afternoons are free, you have time to enjoy the destination and reflect on what you learned, which makes it far more likely to stick. That balance is one reason Continuing Education Company enjoys one of the highest return attendee rates in CME, with many clinicians coming back year after year and often bringing colleagues, friends, and family members along with them. If either of those conferences interest you, it's worth taking a look sooner rather than later, since discounted hotel room blocks often fill up well before the meeting. And if you can't make it to the conferences in person, many Continuing Education Company meetings are available as live webcasts, allowing you to participate from your office, home, or wherever you choose. You'll experience the same expert faculty and evidence-based education in real time while earning live CME credits. And if on-demand learning works better for your schedule, CEC also offers a large library of online CME courses. And for Curbsiders listeners, there's a special offer. Use promo code CURB30 for 30% off all online courses and webcasts. That's promo code CURB30 for 30% off all online courses and webcasts. See for yourself why Continuing Education Company is considered a leading source for medical education. Visit cmemeeting.org/curbsiders to learn more. That's cmemeeting.org/curbsiders. It was a Patreon question about, there's from a listener who was sort of tweaking chlorthalidone dosing in order to allow for guideline-directed medical therapy, and it's a utility in pushing 50 milligrams. My gut sense and my answer to sort of that conversation was, if we're in the territory of someone with chronic kidney disease where we are that avid to have them on an ACE or an ARB that we need to talk about pushing chlorthalidone to 50 milligrams, that seems to me cause for a nephrology referral. But this is my long-winded way of asking, like, at what point should we – I'm nervous and have a low threshold just to have people seen by people who know what they're doing. But when do you prefer to see patients? At what stage in this kind of spectrum should we be thinking about you?
Yeah, I mean, I feel that my job is to support the primary care doctor, that at any time that the primary care doctor feels uncomfortable, I'm happy to step in, right? But I work in a city with a million nephrologists, and we're all dying for patients. And there's a lot of areas of the country where that's not the case. And getting a referral to a nephrologist is difficult and takes a long time to get in. And so, I think your assessment is when you're really trying to titrate these drugs and you're using high doses of chlorthalidone, yeah, probably not a bad time to talk to a nephrologist. Absolutely.
I think we should wrap up our first case, because I want to get to the others that we have. So our patient was Cal Lima, this 40-year-old gentleman. So Cy, do you want to make up an ending to the case? Like, how do we sort his hyperkalemia?
So he stopped making banana bread. He said, I need to make sure my sugars are controlled. He started looking into more of just more fresh fruits, vegetables, making sure he's having good enough fiber, and then just went to see his nephrologist pretty regularly.
Okay. Sounds good. Happy ending. How about we get to our next case?
Okay. So we got another one, Kay Lowe. So she's a 55-year-old lady. She's coming into your clinic for 3 months follow-up. She's recently diagnosed with GERD and started taking a proton pump inhibitor to aid with this and has been feeling pretty good overall. Vitals were pretty good in your clinic, and her labs were significant for a potassium of 2.9, creatinine of 1.48, EGFR of 45. That's been relatively unchanged, and a magnesium of 0.9. Her other labs at that time was fine. And so with this case, now we're kind of flipping it to the other end of the spectrum. So what is your framework here when you're dealing with a patient with hypokalemia?
Yeah. So again, just like we were talking about before, I still divide it into intake, distribution, and excretion as kind of the basic framework. And similar to where we were with intake for hyperkalemia is that decreased intake alone is a very unusual cause of hypokalemia. You have this massive source of potassium inside the cells, and it just, and your healthy kidneys can reduce potassium excretion to 10 milliequivalents a day, and you've got 4,000 milliequivalents in the body. It's really difficult to have decreased intake result in hypokalemia. That said, patients with alcoholism, malnutrition, eating disorders, they actually end up having kind of, if you start looking into that, they have increased renal and extrarenal losses of potassium that contribute that. But those patients, those typical stories will present with hypokalemia. And I think we see, you know, especially in my hospital, lots of hypokalemia from alcohol intake, for example. And then, do you have any thoughts on hypokalemia and intake before we move on?
No, I mean, only intake of magnesium, because this person's magnesium deficient as well. But I don't know if you think that's an issue.
I think that's the absolutely the issue here, right? So we'll hold off on the specific diagnosis in this patient. We'll kind of continue on the schema. So then the next is going to be distribution. So increased insulin will move potassium into the cells. Beta agonists, so if they're using inhalers for asthma, that'll cause hypokalemia. And then, of course, periodic paralysis, you know, either sporadic or genetic causes of that need to be considered. They can have pretty profound hypokalemia resulting in paralysis. It's pretty dramatic. And then again, the big dog is going to be excretion. That can be either extrarenal or renal. You know, so diarrhea, fistulas, laxative abuse can all cause hypokalemia. And then renal losses, you know, classic diuretics, unusual Barters and Gitelman, metabolic alkalosis, primary hyperaldo, licorice ingestion, and then hypomag can also cause potassium loss. And then renal tubular acidosis also would be another one that would be an important one. And so kind of a broad differential, and then taking a look at the urine potassium is a great way to kind of nail that down. And then if that urine potassium is very, very low, you have a kidney that's acting appropriately. And so then you're going to look at extrarenal losses or the distribution or decreased intake as the cause. And if you have increased urinary potassium, you'll be thinking about renal losses of potassium. So how do you look at urinary potassium? Right, so you can just take a spot urine potassium, and the line in the sand is about 20. So a urine potassium greater than 20 is going to be renal wasting. A urine potassium less than 20 is going to be appropriate renal response. But the more sophisticated way to look at that is going to be a potassium creatinine ratio. And that's classically done in milliequivalents of potassium divided by millimoles of creatinine, which makes it incredibly difficult to do because we don't get right. What the hell is the correct answer to that? And so the line in the sand is 2.5 there, and you will be able to find the calculation on some of your better medical calculators available on the web. We won't go through the formula to do that conversion. But yeah, so potassium creatinine ratio or just a urine potassium are helpful.
And Paul, what are you more afraid of, hyperkalemia or hypokalemia?
Gosh, you're asking someone who lives in terror. Actually, I could just end the sentence right there. They both make me nervous depending on the patient. But yeah, I'd be actually more curious to hear which one makes Joel more nervous.
Yeah, I feel like my whole career I've been battling hyperkalemia, and that's kind of the job of the nephrologist. Like, we're dealing with patients with the low GFR, we're putting them on drugs that raise the potassium. You know, someone described me as the firefighter arsonist, right? Like, I give them ACE inhibitors that raise their creatinine, and then I said, "Oh, the creatinine's terrible. We need to fix the creatinine." They're like, "It's your fault," right? But there was a recent study that just looked at 1.2 million serum potassiums and then followed the patients that had these serum potassiums for 7 years. So we could relate, hey, this is a potassium and what are the outcomes that's related to that? And what they found was there's a U-shaped curve. So low potassiums and high potassiums both associated with mortality. But it wasn't symmetric. That the steepness on the hypokalemia was actually pretty way higher. So the average potassium in the cohort was 4.3, which sounds right. But you got a significant increase in mortality when the potassium went below 3.9, which shouted, I was like, wow, that's pretty high. And you didn't see the increased mortality for potassium until it went above 5.2. So it was a much more gradual rise in mortality on the high side and much more significant on the low side. So that was concerning to me.
Which I will say, I was only half joking. You know me, I am terrified all the time. But I will say, at least with hypokalemia, like, I feel pretty good about, like, that's fairly easy to fix, relatively speaking. Like, oh, you need IV, okay. And we can check MAG too, sure, why not? But like the hyperkalemia, it's like magic tricks and we're blowing albuterol in their face, giving them insulin. And then also the medications, like, you're taking something off and seeing it makes a difference. It just seems much more complicated and sort of agonal for the patient too. So I'm actually slightly surprised that it's the hypokalemia that is the one that is a little bit more alarming. But I guess, and this is chronically, right? This is in the study that you're talking about, Joel.
These were baseline creatinines that they then went back and looked at the outcomes 7 years later. So it's, again, it's always hard to relate that, but just trying to get a sense of what the relationship between one and the other is. So, but again, just the idea that that was a much steeper curve, that as that potassium dropped down, we had a much steeper. Right. So there was a study, it was early 2026, called the PODCAST study. And it looked at patients that were high risk for sudden cardiac death. They had patients that had a defibrillator, and they looked at patients that had a potassium less than 4.3. So normal potassium, but the potassium was on the low side for cardiologist view, right? And they randomized them to either a target, a potassium of 4.5 to 5, which is kind of the story that I see the cardiologists write all the time, or usual care. They had 600 in each arm, and they had a composite outcome of looking at VTAC, the ICD firing, arrhythmia or heart failure, or death. And so just changing that, they actually were able to get the potassiums up a little bit. So the usual care group, their potassium was right around 4.0, between 4.0 and 4.1. And the intervention group got up to 4.3. So they didn't get their target of 4.5 to 5, but there was a nice separation of about 0.3 in this group. And the way they did that was most of the patients got shifted from nothing to an MRA plus potassium supplement. That was the biggest group, was they got on both potassium supplement and an MRA to get that delta of about 0.3 in their potassium. And it resulted in a reduction of that outcome from 29% to 22%. So about a 7% reduction, you know, an absolute reduction, which is, you know, number needed to treat of 12, right? That's pretty significant, 12.3 for, and that's a 5 years. 12 point, and, you know, always need, whenever you get a number needed to treat, you always need some, well, over what period of time? So pretty significant period of time, but not that high of a number. And so, you know, it just kind of validates what the cardiologists have been saying. Hey, this is an important finding. You want to get that, you want to protect the heart by rolling that potassium a little bit higher than what you'd expect normally.
Yeah. Sorry to all the interns listening who are repleting potassium every morning.
Yeah, that's right.
I know this,
keep
we're talking about chronic.
You're doing important work here. You're doing important work is what I'm trying to say. It's not meaningless.
Yes. And speaking
you're
of,
making a difference.
Sai, why don't we get back to our case here? Because I want to try to fix this. I'm going to try to fix this person, K low, right? Who's on a PPI and also has a magnesium that's low, as well as a potassium that's low.
Mm-hmm. So in Ms. K low's kind of condition. So she's going to start taking some potassium and magnesium supplements. But her question is, what does she end up doing with the proton pump inhibitor? Is this a scenario where cutting the dose would be something that she should think about, or just kind of nixing it completely? How would you kind of go about that?
Yeah. So this is a setup. We do know that proton pump inhibitors cause malabsorption of magnesium. And it's a pretty straightforward diagnosis. You take a look at that urinary magnesium. You do a fractional excretion of magnesium. So you take the urine magnesium, urine creatinine, serum magnesium, serum creatinine, pump it through a calculator that you'll find on the web. And you'll find that they are incredibly magnesium avid. They are holding on to every filtered magnesium molecule. None of it's getting into the urine because they don't have a magnesium leak in the kidney. Right. You know, we get those magnesium leaks in patients that get platinum or toxicity. They will have a magnesium leak. That is not the case here. These patients have absolutely intact kidneys. This is the proton pump inhibitor blocks magnesium absorption in the gut. And that problem there is you can take all the oral magnesium you want. It's not going to fix it. You need to stop the proton pump inhibitor. Probably need to put them on IV magnesium. Fix that. And once you fix the magnesium, then their potassium handling will normalize. Because they will, otherwise they'll just waste potassium. You'll eat potassium, it'll just come out in the urine. And so fix the magnesium, that'll allow the kidneys to fix the potassium. And it's recurrent. They go back on the proton pump inhibitor, they'll get the same problem. And so the patients need to balance that. I have a patient who's got terrible GERD and gets terrible hypomagnesemia with bad cramps. And he'll go on to the proton pump inhibitor for 2 or 3 weeks, and then he'll have to go off of it because of the cramps and kind of cycles back and forth on it. It's not been a satisfying solution.
I wonder if the PCABs cause the same thing. I just thought of it right now. The potassium competitive acid blockers, like the vonoprazan, is the new. We first started hearing about them in the H. pylori. Like in some of those, but now they're approved for basically refractory GERD. It's a new drug, so it probably costs $1 billion. But Paul, what were you going to say about it?
No, not about that. I think we're effectively married at this point, because as Joel was saying that, I saw a series of expressions cross your face. I knew exactly what question you were going to ask in follow up. Like I knew you were going to ask about the PCABs, and I was excited to hear the answer.
I don't know the answer, but I'm going to see that patient soon, and I'm going to prescribe. I'm going for it.
Yeah, just look it up first, because I don't know that it's definitely it might have cause the same kind of, you know, magnesium loss or malabsorption but I don't know. Okay. Well, so we've sorted out Kalo and Sai. I think we have one last case that's a quick one, but definitely super interesting. So let's get into that.
Yeah. So our third case is Miss Renvela. So she's a 50-year-old lady who's on dialysis. Potassium control has actually been an issue for her, despite being adherent with her dialysis and making the appropriate dietary changes and adopting more fiber as well. Her monthly labs are showing that she's having a persistently elevated potassium of 5.9. So in this situation with the dialysis patients and this persistently elevated potassium, how does your framework change, or what are you thinking about in these cases?
Yeah. So, you want to go to the same framework, but we know that their kidneys don't work. We know that they have a difficulty of getting rid of the potassium. Dialysis ends up being incredibly effective at controlling hyperkalemia, and it's not that common of a problem, but it's not unheard of. And so, you know, I would say somewhere around 15% of my dialysis patients, 15 to 20%, will have problems with hyperkalemia. And so it's a regular finding on the dialysis shifts when I'm doing my rounds, I'll see some hyperkalemia. And in some patients, it's persistent and pretty severe. And people have been using, though off label, the new potassium binders as an option there. You know, they'll go down to we can adjust the potassium in the bath, but we don't go below a 2 potassium bath. That's as low as we'll go. We find increased arrhythmia when you go lower than that the hypokalemia becomes problematic. And so once they're on a 2K bath, we'll use some of these potassium binders. And so there was an interesting study that looked at it and said, hey, maybe using these potassium binders can reduce these cardiovascular outcomes. Maybe part of the problem with these patients that have hyperkalemia is they're getting hyperkalemic arrhythmia, and that's causing a lot of this mortality. And so there was a trial that randomized patients with pre-dialysis hyperkalemia, so potassiums with greater than 5.5. It was called the Dialyze Outcomes Trial. And they randomized them to sodium zirconium cyclosilicate. And they titrated the dose to keep their potassium normalized and at the beginning of dialysis. Enrolled a ton of patients, and they were looking for a reduction in their primary outcome, which was sudden cardiac death, stroke, or hospitalization for arrhythmia. It was a composite outcome. And they ran into two troubles. One, they had way fewer outcomes. It was an outcome-driven trial, and they were looking for 750 outcomes, and after a year, they only had less than half. And so they're like, ooh, this is going to take a lot longer than we anticipated. And the other thing they ran into is about a third of patients just stopped taking the drug, mostly in the intervention group, right? It was a placebo-controlled trial, so everybody was taking some kind of powder in the morning on non-dialysis days. But patients could tell, and they were stopping the zirconium more than they were stopping the placebo.
You're saying they could tell if they got zirked or not?
They could tell if they were getting zirked. That's exactly right. And so with a third of the patients losing the drug and the outcome is accruing at a very slow rate, they were like, we're never getting to our outcome. And so that trial was abandoned. They did find that patients randomized to zirconium normalized their potassium a lot better. And they had a way lower need for rescue therapy. So in terms of like what the drug does, what it says in the tin, it controlled their potassium. It prevented that hyperkalemia. They did get excess hypokalemia, which probably was a concern there. They had about double the rate of hypokalemia, 3% versus 1.4%. But so generally a fail. Like it controlled the potassium, but it didn't result in the reduction in the outcomes that they were really looking for. The other trial that was more interesting, this was done a year before that, and this was looking at maybe we can use zirconium cyclosilicate to prevent hypokalemia, which is a weird thing to think about. But this is how this trial went. They took, again, same population, patients that had pre-dialysis hyperkalemia, so potassiums from 5 to 6.5, and they did this, they had to have it two Mondays in a row. So they after the 2-day break in dialysis. So it could either be a Monday for Monday, Wednesday, Friday patients or a Tuesday for Tuesday, Thursday, Saturday patients. So the patients, the time where you'd expect the potassium to be high enough. And then all the patients got a loop recorder placed. And then they were randomized to either a 2K bath, which is a standard move when you see hyperkalemia, oh, put them on a 2K bath, or a 3K bath plus zirconium. So we're going to put them on a high potassium bath, but we'll allow them to tolerate that by giving them the zirconium cyclosilicate. And they ran that for 8 weeks, and then both parties switched. It was a crossover trial. And because they had the loop recorder, they were just recording AFib events and what they called clinically significant cardiac arrhythmias. And they found a dramatic reduction in these arrhythmias in the 3K bath. So essentially, you know, what their theory was is that putting these patients that have twitchy hearts on a 2K bath promoted a lot of arrhythmias. And if we could avoid those periods of hypokalemia by putting them on a higher K bath supported by the zirconium, we kept the heart stable. So it was a way to prevent hypokalemia by using zirconium cyclosilicate. And it was
an implantable loop recorder?
An implantable loop recorder. Yeah, they went
Holy
all in.
Holy smokes, what a study. This is...
Yeah, right? Isn't that amazing?
Bananas all the way through. Holy cow.
Yeah, bananas is the right term. Yeah, you got that.
And so, for the audience who are not nephrologists, the my understanding of the baths is like your blood is we were just talking about, let's say everyone has a K of 4.5 and they're on a 2K bath. That's a much bigger gradient, so it's going to be a much more rapid shift versus a 3K bath, which is less of a gradient.
100%. Thanks, Matt. Yeah, that's exactly right. That when we talk about the baths, it's how much of the diffusion we're going to be pulling, how much potassium we're going to be pulling off. And we use 2K baths regularly, and you read the study, and you're like, boy, maybe I shouldn't, right? Like, maybe I'm really causing some problems here. So it was an interesting study. The outcome, again, is arrhythmias. It wasn't patient-oriented outcomes. These were things that could only be detected with a loop recorder. I think we need to be careful not to overinterpret this. If you're a EBM nerd or old, you remember the CAST trial from the late 80s in which patients that were post-MI were given antiarrhythmics, and the antiarrhythmics suppressed PVCs, but also increased sudden cardiac death. So it made the EKG look pretty, but the patients died. And so a cautionary tale, you know, because this does kind of feel cast-like because it was not a patient-oriented outcome, but it's certainly kind of, it's intriguing. And it, as these potassium binders become more available, less expensive, this may be a treatment strategy or at least a way to think about how we're going to deal with hyperkalemia in dialysis patients.
Yeah. Super interesting. I like learn about what goes on in a dialysis unit, Paul, because I do take care of some patients that receive dialysis, and I need to know what's going on in there.
No, I remember from residency, there's a lot of beeps and boops, and it's also the worst place in the world for a code other than the MRI scanner. So those are the things I mostly remember about dialysis.
All true. The MRI scanner, still worse.
Yeah. I can't imagine anything being worse than that.
Oh my God, so bad.
All right, so maybe we're going to sprinkle in some, maybe we're going to switch her over to, I don't know, Sai, how are we going to fix her? You're the nephrologist here, so what are we, how do you want to end this case before we get to our take-home points?
I think I just had one quick question, though, ending. So just kind of like with the goal-directed medical therapies that are out there, is there any, how do you kind of approach those in patients on with end-stage kidney disease and on dialysis with RAS inhibitors, SGLT2s? Is there any changes in terms of how you approach dosing of those and administering those medications?
Yeah, so this is a question that comes up a lot. Like, what do we do with GDMT in our dialysis population? And so, you know, the basic strategy is, we don't have good data. In all the GDMT trials, these patients were excluded. And so that's a problem with how we're doing equity in terms of our studies. We should not be excluding these patients. But it also is true that they need to be studied separately because they probably have a different pathophysiology driving a lot of their heart failure. And so including them in a general population probably is inappropriate. That said, we don't have great data on what to do with them. And in the absence of data, we just press on regardless. And there's some intriguing, small, suggestive trials with SGLT2 inhibitors that looks like they still get cardiovascular benefit. This is kind of from the big SGLT2 inhibitor trials. Some of those patients in the CKD trials ended up on dialysis. Now, fewer of the patients on SGLT2 inhibitors than on placebo ended up on dialysis, but some in both groups did. Starting dialysis was not a stopping point in the trial. These patients continued on their study drugs even when they were on dialysis. And so we could then look at outcomes of the patients that ended up on dialysis, and there was still a cardioprotective effect of the SGLT2 inhibitors in that population. We are now enrolling patients for a dedicated ESRD trial with SGLT2 inhibitors, and we will, you know, stay tight. We're going to get that data eventually. And then interestingly, the MRAs have been studied deliberately in dialysis populations, and they did not work. And so the MRAs would be one that you could comfortably stop in this population. They do have a hypotensive effect. So if you have blood pressures that are really difficult to treat among your dialysis patients, you can use spironolactone, but they do not work in terms of their cardioprotection. There's been multiple trials that have looked at that. They've all been negative. None of them have shown any signal there. And so you can comfortably stop those. GLP-1 RAs, I think, are super interesting because one of the other issues that we have, at least in some of our dialysis patients, is patients that gain a ton of weight between treatments. They just drink a lot of fluid. Super interested in whether GLP-1 receptor agonists work there. Anecdotally, I've seen it work in patients. I really like to see a trial kind of verify what my kind of personal biases and experiences are. But that looks very promising to me. And there's suggestions that the ACE inhibitors also work in this population. And so outside of the MRAs, I would press on regardless as best you can. Oh, and then just one other thing. Even though most of their potassium excretion is done via dialysis, we still see hyperkalemia effects from the ACE inhibitors and from the mineralocorticoid receptor antagonists. So need to be aware of that. Mm-hmm. Hyperkalemia is still an issue there.
Yeah. And we're assuming no residual renal function in this conversation.
Well, we still see the hyperkalemia in patients with no residual renal function. This is, we believe that the aldosterone is important for colonic potassium excretion. That, like I said, that becomes an important part of clearance in these patients.
Okay. All right. Cy, are we ready to wrap up this case and go to take-home points?
Let's do it.
Okay. So how are you going to resolve this for Ms. Renvela?
So I'm feeling a little adventurous. I'm going to try this 3K bath with the Zerk combination and just kind of see how it goes.
I love it.
Make sure she's got a high fiber diet, moving her bowels regularly to avoid constipation there.
And probably place a loop recorder just to be on the safe side.
Yeah.
How will you know it's working otherwise?
Paul, would it make you so happy if, like, we started seeing these commercials for, like, get Zerked, and it's like, it's like the pharma just takes, like, a new approach to their ads. Instead of, like, people holding hands walking through a wheat field, it's like, it's more like a Mountain Dew commercial getting
like
Zerked.
Extreme potassium reduction. Yeah. Just skydiving and just sucking down powder. It sounds great.
Yeah, I like this, Paul. Why are we doing our day jobs? We should be writing.
We shouldn't be giving this away for free. This should at least be a Patreon episode of nothing else. Yeah, no, you're making a lot of good points here, Matt.
Okay, cool. Take home points now.
Let's go. So with hyperkalemia, so in patients, and this episode, this was great because we did a previous hyperkalemia episode, like in 2017, that was really focused on the acute management and inpatient management. So for all new interns that are listening to this, go find that old episode of hyperkalemia. I'm sure you'll put a link into the show notes. It really covered very different ground than this one. This episode is much more focused on, hey, you're in clinic and you got a patient with mild hyperkalemia. How do we think about it? And we talked about pseudo hyperkalemia. We talked about the lack of a relationship between dietary potassium. So don't spend a lot of time focusing on dietary advice. That's really not going to be helpful in these patients. You're going to really go off in the wrong direction, and that we're going to focus on. We went through a good list of the medications that cause hyperkalemia and how to think about those medications. And then in terms of management, don't sleep on your diuretics, use your loop diuretics, use your thiazide type diuretics. Go ahead and treat their metabolic alkalosis with some sodium bicarbonate. Go ahead and treat their metabolic acidosis with some sodium bicarbonate. Get that corrected. That is also going to help that. And then make sure their patients are not constipated. When it came to hypokalemia, we talked about whether that can be renal losses or extrarenal losses, and that we talked about magnesium as being an important component of that and the proton pump inhibitors being involved there. Before that, we also went in and we talked about the potassium switch, which I just need to talk about because I think it's so darn cool. And this potassium switch is new physiology that we've discovered where it's the kidney just not leaving anything to chance, taking care of that potassium. That increased potassium intake has a thiazide-like effect, which is going to cause increased potassium excretion and increased sodium excretion. So you'll get some hypotensive effect, and that was put into action in the SAS trial in rural China, where we were able to reduce not only stroke, but total mortality by giving patients additional potassium chloride. And then lastly, we finished off in the dialysis unit, where you should always finish off your dialysis, always finish off your rounds in the dialysis unit. And we talked about using some of the new potassium binders in novel ways to treat dialysis patients.
Thank you so much, Joel. As always, we'll have to keep having you back. Someday we're going to have to get like one of our interns to count how many episodes you've been on and get an official count. Because it's definitely approaching 24, maybe 36 that by now. I don't know. It's been a lot.
It's been great. I really enjoyed this.
This has been another episode of The Curbsiders, bringing you a little knowledge food for your brain hole.
Yummy.
Thanks. So grateful. Still hungry for more? Join our Patreon and get all of our episodes ad-free, plus twice monthly bonus episodes at patreon.com/curbsiders. You can find our show notes at thecurbsiders.com and sign up for our mailing list to get our weekly show notes in your inbox. That includes our Curbsiders Digest, which recaps the latest practice-changing articles, guidelines, and news in internal medicine.
And we're committed to high-value, practice-changing knowledge. And to do that, we need your feedback, so please email us at askcurbsiders@gmail.com. A reminder that this and most episodes are available for CME credit for all health professionals through VCU Health at curbsiders.vcuhealth.org. A special thanks to our writer and producer for this episode, Dr. Cy Achi, and to our whole Curbsiders team. Our technical production is done by PodPaste. Elizabeth Proto does our social media. Jen Watto runs our Patreon. Krista Chumanchu moderates our Discord. Stuart Brigham composed our theme music. And with all that, until next time, I've been Dr. Matthew Frank Watto.
Bye, Archie.
And as always, remain Dr. Paul Nelson Williams. Thank you and goodbye.